Welcome to the Co-op Power Hour on KGNU's It's the Economy. I'm Nathan Schneider, a scholar in residence of media studies at CU Boulder. This show is where members of the Colorado Co-op Study Circle join you on the fourth Thursday of every month to explore the challenges and opportunities of people-powered democratic economies. And just to make things confusing, of course, this is the fifth Thursday, but normally it's the fourth Thursday of every month. This is our second show, and we're really glad to be here with you. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're going to be talking about the intersections of Black Lives Matter and cooperative enterprise. Now, for a lot of people, Black Lives Matter is most visible, most well-known as a protest movement, as something that happens in the streets in reaction to incidents of violence, especially by police against Black men. But it's much more than that. It's also, in many cases, a women-led movement, led by people who are have often been less visible. And it's also a movement that has produced a broad and multifaceted platform, a kind of roadmap for social justice in the United States of America. Not just a platform for Black lives, I think, but really a platform for all of us, led by people who are working for justice in their communities. The economic justice portion of the Movement for Black Lives platform contains 38 mentions of cognates of cooperative. This tradition of democratic business is alive and well in the Black Lives Matter movement, and it is rooted in a long history of co-ops in Black struggle, going back to, say, Sojourner Truth, who lived in a cooperative community, W.E.B. Du Bois, who in 1907, for instance, produced an incredible catalog of African-American co-ops around the United States at that time and helped develop an organization of African-American co-ops. Co-ops were part of the struggle for voting rights. They were part of the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s, also part of the rise of Black power and movements for Black autonomy and nationalism throughout the later 20th century. And this continues to this day. For more on this history, I can't recommend more a recent book by Jessica Gordon Nembhard, a scholar at John Jay College in New York City, called Collective Courage. And it's a history of African-American cooperation that's an absolutely vital resource. Dr. Gordon Nembhard was a guest on our show last month, and so you can go back and listen to our interview with her. But today we have some new guests. We have Vince Bowen, who's part of the Colorado area chapter of Black Lives Matter, BLM 5280, and Beverly Grant with Mo Better Greens, a local food business entrepreneur and also a host of On the Heel Tip, Healthy Eating, Active Living, which airs here on KGNU every other Wednesday at 3 p.m. Later on in the show, we'll hear from Alandria Williams, who's with the Highlander Center, a really important place for research and education in Tennessee. And she's one of the leaders of the national resurgence in cooperative enterprise, especially in African-American communities. And she'll help us see some of the broader picture going on. With that, again, thank you so much for joining us. This is a production of the Colorado Co-op Study Circle. You can learn more about us at coloradocoops.info. We've got a directory of co-ops around the state, and we've got a series of events just about every month. We're bringing together people interested in democratic enterprise to hone their skills and meet each other. Thanks so much for joining us. To get this conversation started, I want to turn to some people who are really leading the way for cooperative enterprise in the Colorado area. Vince Bowen, who's a member of the core leadership team of Black Lives Matter 5280, and Beverly Grant, who's a local food entrepreneur with Mo Better Greens and also a host of a show here on KGNU on the Heel Tip every other Wednesday at 3 p.m. I'm going to start with Vince. Vince, can you tell us a bit about where Black Lives Matter meets this kind of tradition of democratic economic practice? How does this movement that's known for its protests in many cases get involved in business?
Absolutely. And, you know, I will start with just a sort of elucidation or elaboration of the Black Lives Matter historical mission. So, yes, we are definitely known in the media, particularly portrayed in the media, as focusing on violence against black men in particular. But really, what we see is violence that is perpetrated against black women, black queer and transgender folks in particular, and it's almost as though that's the silent story. So we are really focused on improving the lives of black people in general and focusing on those that are most marginalized, because I'm an old Baptist boy, and, you know, we are not a religious organization, obviously, but we incorporate all elements of the black tradition. And I think of we focus on those who are the least amongst us, mm-hmm. and those who are treated by our society as the least amongst us. And that really brings us to the point of what the cooperative movement as an intersection with Black Lives Matter means. If you think about the things that we see going on in terms of state violence, those are really symptoms of a larger problem. And that larger problem is economic oppression. And in America, we have a particularly long tradition, unfortunately, of racialized economic oppression. And what Black Lives Matter has done, if you look at, and you very well or very nicely elucidated some of the platform points of the Movement for Black Lives. I suggest that people go to that Movement for Black Lives for a very detailed, very extensive platform. What we've really focused on is this notion of pulling away from the chains of economic oppression, and in so doing, addressing some of these problems that we see as symptoms of that economic oppression. If I could very quickly just go through sort of our view of the historic economic overlay of American racial oppression. You know, if you go back to you know, colonial times, we had this, you know, group of folks who, by virtue of a ocean cruise, became landed gentry, right? And they got here and they had all this land that was obviously being taken care of and being occupied by Native Americans. And they felt, well, we have a labor problem here. We have an economic opportunity. We just need some labor. So let's get these Native Americans to get working for us and start, you know, exploiting this land. Unfortunately, that did not work, you know, for a number of reasons. One, you know, they could say, hey, I'm going over to that tree and keep going, because they knew the lay of the land. And two, a lot of the diseases that were bought were very particularly fatal for them. So the next approach was indentured servants and folks who had criminal pasts or were paying off a debt in the old country in England, and they came over and worked as indentured servants to work on these plantations to harvest and plant crops. Problem there, again, is that these were white people, right? And when they left the plantation before their servitude, they blended into the population. And even more importantly, at the end of their servitude, they wanted the same rights and privileges as their white counterparts who had employed them. And they wanted land, and they wanted the full measure of all the rights that the landed gentry had. And that was not acceptable, because they the folks who had come here first thought that land and ownership was something that would separate them from their past and from people who were not of the same stature. So at the same time, you have this sort of trade that became the triangle trade, but wasn't happening in the same way as it did over time. So you had sugarcane in the Caribbean that was being taken back to the UK to create rum and create the distilled spirits. And then the boats would come back, the ships would come back empty to pick up more sugarcane. There were colonies in Africa. They realized, hey, wait a second, this is a great deal. We can fill these ships, bring back people who don't look like us. Furthermore, they are people who we can classify as not us. And that started off this, you know, great big, as a DJ in New York used to say, this great big money-making machine of America. You had folks who were brought to this country, didn't know the traditions, didn't know the language. They could easily be enslaved. Furthermore, you had actual laws which codified their lack of humanhood. And this is really where we get at the core of racialization of economic exploitation. If you think about it, in order to subjugate someone and do the horrible things that we know and see of slavery, you've got to dehumanize somebody. So you've got to say, oh, that's not someone like me. That's someone who's part human, somebody who likes to be treated like this. This is like livestock. And this was a mythology that was created not only to make this psychologically abrasive principle or psychologically abrasive institution work, but it was also a way to keep the white folks who were charged with getting labor out of black people and exploiting black people, keep them from having a dissonance in their own lives by realizing, wait a second, my life is not that great. I don't have any land. I'm not making any money. I'm being exploited myself, but at least I don't say the N word. I actually say the word. At least I'm not a nigger, basically. And this is what happened early on. And this tradition, this mythology sticks with us today. So you can look at Ta-Nehisi Coates did a great piece on the case for reparations. And he pointed out that in the New Deal, one of our landmark progressive pieces of legislation, there were carve-outs there that said, okay, Social Security, huge program. It's going to help, you know, create a broad middle class. But in order to get it through the Southern Democratic Congress, the Dixiecrats, they carved out and said that it was available only to people who were not farm or domestic workers. Well, that turned out to be 80% of black folks back in that time. So this was a clear signal to the Democratic Party, to America, that these people don't deserve the same treatment. You know, obviously, it's been going on since Jim Crow. Same thing happened with redlining. So, again, an economic codification of lower valuation, devaluation of black life. We're not going to lend. We're going to have a GI Bill. We're going to have a Fannie Mae, but we're not going to lend in black communities. And what you do in a capitalist society, if you take economic value out of a community and identify people with economic devaluation, then you are devaluing their lives as a whole because money is king. And so what the cooperative movement seeks to do is to counter that by saying, you know what, we have an economic life. There's things like Black Wall Street, you know, in Omaha, Nebraska, where there was a thriving community of business that depended on each other. I talked to my parents, my grandparents who grew up in Harlem, very thriving community of interdependence. My grandfather ran a secondhand clothing store, which, you know, when he died at our Baptist church, the eulogy, I remember one of the deacons said, you know, Mr. Bowen didn't make a whole lot of money in his store, but his wealth was in his contribution to his community. So not a formal co-op, but pointing out that there's a historical tradition of black businesses that work within our communities and actually end up not only providing wealth and opportunity for the people that run them, but a value and a wealth for the community.
Yeah, and that reminds me that in that 1907 report by W.E.B. Du Bois, he suggests that there are cooperative features in every African-American business of that time. Now, he was concerned about what would become of that, you know, mm-hmm. and whether as African-Americans gained more wealth, whether that would remain the case. But in many cases, I think it is that in a community of that experiences marginalization, cooperation becomes a necessity, and it takes form in, you know, in any kind of business that people construct, regardless of the ownership structure in the legal documents, to the extent that they exist.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I point to there's a German philosopher who points out that the lives of the oppressed actually end up or the social capital of the oppressed ends up being formed by having to survive in an oppressive system. So we adapt and we change the way that we live in order to survive in a system that doesn't want to let us survive. And in so doing, some of the things that happen actually end up being models for ways to take an alternative approach to thriving in a capitalist system that doesn't want you to thrive.
I want to bring Beverly Grant into this conversation and really zero in on where the legacy that Vince has just outlined for us connects to the experience of African Americans in Colorado. Beverly, are you with us? Can you tell us a bit about your business, your involvement in natural food, and how that intersects with the history that Vince just outlined?
Wow, thank you so much for the opportunity to be a part of the conversation. You know, Vince said kind of gingerly some really heavy things. Mm-hmm. And I just want to dovetail a couple of those things because, quite honestly, they are part of what I've built my work and momentum around. First, let's think about, like Vince kind of talked about, how the ability for the have and have nots has been created through legislation, basically, and different laws. And how about this, fast forwarding to today, all of our 50 states have food deserts, which kind of dovetails what Vince was talking about with kind of moving groups of folks around geographical places, disallowing resources to exist where they exist, and then redlining, which means restricting you to be within a particular geographic area. Well, how about deserts are particular geographic areas with particular folk, usually people of color, and some of the things that Vince just talked about, these food deserts were created. They weren't always food deserts. And let's talk about here locally, Park Hill in particular, where Vince's work is going on. Now, Vince's work also has an element of food justice because exactly in the area where Vince wants to do the work, there, that used to be a thriving hub right there at the Holly Shopping Center. That's what we used to call that because I grew up there. And there was a Safeway store there. When I used to go there with my parents as a child in elementary school. And then it was closed. And how about to this present day, and I have, my oldest child is 28. To the present day, there has been no effort to really bring food back into that community until now. And where the MHCD campus is, which is at Dahlia a few blocks away, you know, there's another food justice effort that happened there, which resulted in a 1-acre in-ground farm, 5,400 square foot aquaponic farm where a King Soopers used to exist back when I was in elementary school. So what Vince tends to do with his work through building a co-op, number one, it's going to create connection. It's going to provide a place for history, needs, and unity to kind of come together. Also, it's going to create what I call a habit of progress, a habit of success, in that the folks that come together to create this co-op, every single person has value. Every single person, you know, is going to be able to accumulate wealth, you know, in the same way, you know, at the same rate. You know, there's equitability there. And then it kind of shifts this culture we have of evaluative thinking, you know, to think about, you know, how are we going to create more justice, if you will, for those that have lived in the fringes, you know, all these times. And so creating this economic vehicle that brings people together around a mission, which is what cooperative economics is about, is a brilliant way to do that. And then segueing to me and my food work, say a little bit more than 10 years ago when I realized what a food desert was and what that definition was, and I realized that my home neighborhood is a food desert, that made me want to be a part of the solution. There's a principle that I believe in called the problem is the solution. It's a permaculture principle. And to be honest, that's what my work is founded on, that very principle. The problem is the solution. I would say that with what Vince is doing, the problem is the solution. You heard him outline problems. You also heard him talk about the solutions that, you know, he's trying to bring forth through the co-op. And the thing that I look at with also utilizing the Black Lives Matter platform, it's a way to create a holistic approach to addressing a myriad of social ills.
Thank you so much. And Vince, I wonder if you could say a bit more about this co-op that Beverly is talking about. What are you building? What is this community building here?
Sure. And thanks, Beverly, for teasing the project that we're doing that I didn't tease myself. So the end point that we're at today, not end point, but the point that we're at today is to say, how do we take ourselves out of an exploitative economic system and make some decisions for ourselves? So Beverly's been doing work that, you know, really just in working with her, I see where she's teaching people about the most powerful decision you can make, which is what you consume, what you put into your body. Taking control of that has a psychological benefit, kind of like the point of, that she made about a habit of success or habit of progress. The point that if you can actually say, hey, wait a minute, I'm not going to let that fast food company, I'm not going to let that 24-hour store determine what my body does and how my life trajectory goes, I'm going to start making those decisions for myself. That can lead to a whole new way of thinking. So what we want to do is go back to those places, back to the place that Beverly talked about, the Holly Square, where there was a store and a set of shops, and we want to, we're in contract to purchase the property there that's just north of the south of the Hiawatha Davis Center. We're going to open a cooperatively owned grocery store, so community owned grocery store, and build some affordable housing units. So we want to create an economic hub, again, where people can have a place where they can thrive and economically interact and also socially interact. You know, so much of what we talk about now with urbanization is being able to walk to places and being able to interact and have a community experience without having to get into your car. There's actually all sorts of data that shows that's a health enhancing thing. So one on the health tip, figuring out ways for us to control the food that comes into our neighborhood and the food that we'll be able to access. And then on the economic tip, we all know about the multiplier effect, right? If you go into Walmart and buy an apple, then you're going to invest in Bentonville, Arkansas. You're going to invest in a food chain that may go halfway around the world. You're going to invest in shareholders who are largely in East Coast cities who are then pursuing policies that don't necessarily serve us. If you invest in an apple in your local community and it's locally sourced, perhaps at Beverly's Farm, maybe a cucumber, then, you know, Beverly's employing people for that. They go out and spend money. So that dollar actually becomes $1.45 by some, and $1.80 by some statistics, because it gets re-spent within the community. So we want to capture some of the dollars that are going outside of the community and bring them back in. There's some work being done on the west side of Denver, the Westwood Community Co-op, which is actually having a meeting tonight on Tuesday, westwoodfoodcoop.com or .org. In any case, they did a study on a three-mile radius in a very poor and working-class immigrant neighborhood. $16 million a year spent on groceries, because people do have to eat, right? But in that three-mile radius, not $16 million of that was spent, only $3 million. So $13 million going out of that small and very, you know, economically disadvantaged community, but a community that's spending that money, but that money is going out. What we want to do is to break that cycle and say, we want to keep some of this money that's being spent in stores that do not have our interests in mind, and bring it back into the community.
I want to jump in there on you, Vince, because you're saying some real important things. One thing I want to say is this movement that you are spearheading is going to redefine what value and wealth. And one thing that I always say is that our health is our true wealth, because if we have a break in our health, all these other things that we think we are doing to generate wealth, not going to happen because we're down. And so, you know, looking at what we are eating, every time we eat or drink a snack, we are investing in that wealth, which is called our health. And so if we are intentional about that, you know, it does create a spiral, you know, of, you know, where our dollars are going, where our other resources are going. And then the other thing I want to talk about is the definition of wealth, which is not money. And I feel that community currency is a term that I have come to embrace over my years, which is something that I have built, which is absolutely not money. And I built this with individuals and entities and nonprofits and organizations and small businesses, a reciprocity-based relationship where I'm giving them something, and in return, I am receiving something. You know, and it, and we're not exchanging money, but needs are being met. And so this, there's also the opportunity to bring this type of thinking back to the forefront through cooperative economics. Because, again, this is relationship-based.
Well, the wealth multiplying that you're talking about is not only a very powerful thing, it can be a dangerous thing, you know, when you look at this history. And you know, in the 50s and 60s, it wasn't just people at lunch counters found themselves getting hurt. It was cooperators in the South who were black cooperators farming on land that they co-owned, and they'd find their truck full of cucumbers would get stopped on the road and held up all day until the cucumbers had turned to mush, and then the sheriffs would let them go. You know, and Vince mentioned earlier Black Wall Street. Well, that burned down, and that was no accident. And so it's really important that these efforts, you know, when we recognize their power, can receive wide support. So I'd like to ask each of you, and we've got to wrap up now, but I'd like to ask each of you how listeners can support what you're doing. Beverly, do you want to start?
Oh, sure. And thank you for giving me that opportunity. What I would say for you listeners, if you wish to connect with me, I'm very easy to find on Facebook, and just message me there. I have two pages. Mo Betta Green, which is a friend page, and then Mo Betta Green Marketplace. Either page, you could send me a message, and if you desire to work on the urban farm or be a part of a farmer's market, or there's even more, please reach out.
And I will add to that, Beverly, maintaining our cultural language tradition. That's Mo, M-O, Betta, B-E-T-T-A, because we have a rich tradition of taking language and making it ours and making it special and making it feel like home. So Mo Betta Greens and Mo Betta Greens Marketplace.
Green.
Right?
Yeah, Green, Green, G-R-E-E-N, no S.
Oh, no
People
S, okay.
Love to give me that S.
And for Black Lives Matter 5280, we are at blacklivesmatter5280.org on the web, and we have a Facebook page, also a like page, and we will be launching a fundraising effort. What we want to do, we're funding this purchase mainly with grants, foundation grants, but we want to have a community element of it. So we're going to be raising a modest amount amongst community members just to show the buy-in and give people a chance to be invested. And what we really like to tell people is that, you know, there's lots of allies who really appreciate and understand that the mission of Black Lives Matter is freedom from oppression for all, which we're seeing. If we forget about the least amongst us becomes all of us. And if you are an ally and you want to support, here's a great way to get involved, to spread the word, and to if you want to reach out and have some foundation relationships, we welcome all to be involved in an active way.
Well, thank both of you so much. I'm so glad to hear your voices here. You're listening to the Co-op Power Hour on KGNU's It's the Economy. I'm Nathan Schneider. I'm here with Vince Bowen of Black Lives Matter 5280 and Beverly Grant of Mo Betta Green. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more backward thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There is so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh.
Welcome back to the Co-op Power Hour on KGNU's It's the Economy. I'm Nathan Schneider, a scholar in residence of media studies at CU Boulder. This is a show where members of the Colorado Co-op Study Circle join you on the fourth Thursday of every month to explore the challenges and opportunities of people-powered democratic economies. Just to make things confusing, of course, this is the fifth Thursday of March, but normally it's the fourth Thursday, so stay tuned for future shows and follow our events and podcasts at coloradocoops.info. Today we're talking about the intersection of cooperative enterprise and the Black Lives Matter movement, a movement that's been known and presented most in the media, at least, as a protest movement. And it is that, but it's also a movement that's galvanized a vision for a way forward on all sorts of levels, especially an economic level, recognizing that oppression of people of color in this country is intimately linked with economy. And, you know, if you look at the vision for Black Lives at the Movement for Black Lives website, which you can find online, there's a lot of proposals for what it would take to build cooperative economies that are really rooted in communities and that enable marginalized communities to gain economic power. Among those proposals are to divest from the fossil fuel economy and invest in a cooperative loan fund that can allow money to go into developing black-led cooperatives. And we also see calls for cooperative organizations to shift resources toward a more local and sustainable economy, and incentivizing cities, for instance, to direct procurement contracts to cooperatives, transferring city-owned land to community land trusts, a whole variety of concrete proposals for how to develop a more people-centered democratic economy. Now, this isn't just talk. This is work that is already underway, and one of the leaders in that work is our next guest, Alandria Williams. Williams is a member of the education team at the renowned Highlander Center for Research and Education, whose alums include Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks. She helps coordinate the Appalachian Transition Fellowship Program and the Southern Grassroots Economies Project, which includes the ambitious Southern Reparations Loan Fund. She's also on the board of the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network. She's one of the leading young cooperative developers around, and she can help us see the broader picture beyond just the work we've been hearing about in Colorado. Thank you so much for joining us, Alandria.
Thank you, Nathan.
Can you start us off with the big picture? What's happening at the intersection, as you see it, between the struggle for Black lives and cooperative enterprise? Where do they intersect?
Well, to me, they intersect everywhere. I was blessed to be able to help work on the Movement for Black Lives policy platform, and to really put in a lot and work with other people to put in some of the really good stuff around cooperatives and solidarity economics and ways that we can shift power. From the beginning, even before slavery, people on the continent, people in the Caribbean, they already had cooperatives. They had cooperative enterprises. So I define cooperatives, and I think a lot of us think about them as before the Rochdale rules, right? Before Rochdale in Europe came about. But how do we actually work together in a way to get our basic needs met, whether it's food, whether it's housing, whether it's clothing, whether it's water? And those types of cooperatively ran things have been happening since time immemorial, right? And so in every state, so there's kind of a seminal book around some of this is by Jessica Gordon Imhart, who wrote Collective Courage, has really been around how at every stage of, like, resistance and every stage of us being cooperatives and ways of cooperatively working together has played a part of liberation and freedom, right? Because we understood that there's no way to have political freedom without economic freedom, and that actually when people had the most economic freedom is actually when the repression hit. And so you can just look at all the many race riots that happened in the 1900s and the 1800s, and they all came about because of actually cooperatives and people really working together for their own economic liberation. And so right now, how it's coming is in some really powerful ways. So most people, of course, know about what happened in Ferguson and Michael Brown. And so we're running this amazing economics and governance curricula. And so right in Ferguson and in St. Louis, Solidarity Economy St. Louis is like, how do we create a different kind of way of being out of this? And so understanding that a lot of the people who are getting arrested, so a lot of this happened because of policing and the way the policing works. They're like, how do we use time banking and how do we use cooperatives to deal with what's happening in the police state? How do we actually shift and use cooperatives to help us change our participatory governance? So out of what happened in Ferguson, they had a Solidarity Economy cooperative response, which is really unbelievable and amazing, and is shifting power. You see it in Baltimore. You see it in Jackson, Mississippi, which a lot of people know about, around cooperation in Jackson. There are so many different ways that people from all over the country and the world, frankly, there are people using credit unions to help build the wells and build community schools, because that's the way for people to come together. And so cooperatives, we believe, are essential. And cooperatives, not just in the only, like, a form, but how do we come together across all the many aspects of our communities, all the many ways that we think things should be made, and how do we actually create something tangibly on the ground? And we believe that, especially in the time we're in right now, we're in a crazy time, kind of one that most people in my age group, I'm 37, 38, there hasn't been one since almost like right when NAFTA hit or in the early 1980s, where we're seeing a lot of programs being rolled back. So if there is no public funding for Meals on Wheels, then that means we have to have a cooperative response to feeding our elderly and people that are disabled. If there is no funding for the arts, how do we ourselves fund the arts? And so really, the cooperatives right now have a much bigger need than they may have had 40 years ago, because now we are going to be realistically put in a position in which we're going to have to say, okay, we have to actually make our own needs manifest. And so how do we use different forms of enterprises and different forms of working together to make that happen?
Right.
Well, and that is how really it intersects with what it means to have Black Lives Matter.
Well, what you're talking about in this moment is a real crisis for the kind of the cooperative movement as it stands in the U.S. When you look at Donald Trump's proposal for the budget, it ends up slashing a lot of the major programs that have supported the existing cooperative movement, especially through the Department of Agriculture. But you're working on building a new generation from the bottom up of support structures for cooperatives, you know, because no kind of business exists in a vacuum. You know, every kind of business requires an ecosystem, and that goes from Wall Street to a cooperative grocery store.
So you
tell us a bit about, for instance, the Southern Grassroots Economies Project. What's it doing? What are you doing there to help these kinds of businesses grow and develop and be healthy?
Yeah, and you know, and so I think just like everything else, we are in an innovation process. So we started the Southern Grassroots Economies Project. Now, oh my goodness, it's been 7 years ago. And this SGP was really started to start doing some co-op education. At that point, we had the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. There were some longstanding worker co-ops in Western North Carolina and some in Austin, Texas, and a little burgeoning co-op movement to other places. But it wasn't really, a lot of people hadn't taken hold of it. And we really were trying to figure out, how do we get people who are in our work that are very good at the fight, very good at the resistance, very good at the struggle, one aspect of the struggle, to think through, okay, yes, but we're fighting, but what are we fighting for, and how do we create those things ourselves? And so we started SGP, and it also came out of, I'm on the board of the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network, and when we would bring people to things, there'd be a whole bunch of people from all over the country, and really it'd be mostly middle-class white people. It'd be a lot of middle-class white people from all over the country, and we decided that didn't make sense for us. One, that we mostly work with people of color, or low-income white people, and they're in the South and in Appalachia. And so we were like, we need to figure out what we, and immigrants and undocumented folks, what do we do to address that need? And so the first thing we did was create a thing called Co-Opicon, which was designed to be a gathering of Southern and Appalachian people who wanted to think about what it meant for them to do work around the solidarity economy. And it was designed specifically for people of color and low-income white people and people who most cooperative things are not designed for at all. And so we started asking people, what are the things that people needed? Well, we realized that finance was major. And so we started working with the Working World and others to create the Southern Reparations Loan Fund. And it's clearly called reparations for a reason, because we believe that money needs to be moved from people who stole it to people who had it stolen from. And to really try to do that financing work. But we also discovered that in that, well, if you don't have a co-op and if there's not a good pipeline, then it doesn't matter if there's financing. So we've been doing a lot of on-the-ground technical assistance and supporting groups and helping people their business plans and their community engagement and their performance and all that to help them get off the ground. Some people in West Virginia and Mississippi and other places, so most southern states don't have cooperative enabling legislation. And so then the policy committee started doing work around state-based cooperative enabling legislation, which connected to the national USDA Department of Agriculture. And right now we're in the process of going, well, what does all that mean, and now where do we go? Because that was right for then. Parts of it are right for now, but it's not all right for now. And so we're still in a discernment process around, okay, well, where are we going? How does this fit? Some of us have started curricula building off of it because people needed to start in a different place other than just coming to a conference. And so we're still in that process of figuring out what makes the most sense for groups. And I think one of the things that's been really helpful, and so out of that, I also got involved in a thing called Beautiful Solutions, which is really looking at what are some of the most powerful stories that people are doing all over the world. Because we recognize that really a lot of the beautiful cooperative work isn't happening in the U.S. It's happening over the, it's all happening all over the world. And it's happening in people's home countries. And it's happening especially like in the middle of movement time in Nicaragua and El Salvador and Colombia and like in Zimbabwe. They're happening everywhere. And so what are lessons we can learn around how to do things? That maybe there's some lessons from Thailand that we can't use from New York. And so that's been one powerful thing that's really happened is what is an internationalist perspective of this movement so that our folks also understand what that means both globally and in their local area.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of learning happening across all sorts of lines. I mean, I've got Vince Bowen here with Black Lives Matter here in Colorado, and they're working on developing a co-op. A food co-op, grocery co-op, and a food desert, and they've been looking to the Renaissance Food Co-op project in North Carolina, which is connected with the work that you've been doing.
It is, yes. And so the Renaissance Co-op is amazing, and you should definitely look at them. There's also a couple of other ones that are also extraordinarily powerful. So I live in Knoxville, Tennessee, and so our food co-op, Three Rivers, came about with, and they're in a place where there's a food desert also. And they've been around for 30 years. And so my dad and mom were actually original members, founding members, which to me is a beautiful and incredible thing. And so there's all these stories of these food co-ops, some that are like brand new, like Renaissance, and others that are a little older, that are also all working together to try to figure this out. And I'm super excited to hear about the food co-op in Colorado, because I think we all have to learn from each other.
Well, Andrea, it is just, it's a wonderful treat to hear you talk about the work that you're doing, and I definitely think we'll be collaborating in the future. And one of the things that I just want to highlight that you said is really interesting and sort of dovetails with what Beverly Grant said. She made a point about sometimes the problem is the solution. And your point and the fact that you're talking about taking an approach to capitalism that says, how do we meet our basic needs and how do we work together? The myth of American individualism and, rugged economic isolation is just that. It's a myth. I mean, if you look at the Chamber of Commerce, if you look at, I worked at Goldman Sachs, that's a great big collusion project. And the idea that we are working alone as individuals is the reason why we don't have health insurance. And it's the great evil genius of racial separation in America. You know, you can tell poor white folks, hey, listen, don't worry about your economic well-being. Don't worry about your health. Just be white, okay? Just be like me. And you get what we have today. We have a Donald Trump saying to somebody who needs aid to who needs food stamps, who needs health care, who needs investment in cooperative communities, that person saying, I don't want that because I want to be identified as the elite. And this is ridiculous.
So here's the other thing that I think, like, because I live in Appalachia, and so it helps to be able, I was like, oh, yes, I can always bring nuance because of where I live and who I get to be around.
Yeah.
I think part of the thing that we also forget is that some of the strongest cooperative efforts happened in this region of poor white people, and then they got completely demolished by the federal government, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's this amazing story of these guys in Appalachian, Ohio. All of these coal miners were trying to figure out how did they actually start a cooperative coal industry. Because they were like, we're tired of being destroyed. We want to figure out how we start a co-op. So they were like, okay, let's go. They got everything ready, but they had one problem. And I remember hearing the story and went, oh, my gosh. They could not control the tipple. The tipple is this little thing that weighs the coal. Whoever controls the tipple controls the industry. They had everything in place, but they could not control the tipple. Because the tipple You had to get the U.S. government on your side and the coal miners, on the coal owners on your side, and they couldn't. And so then this, mm-hmm. all this 20-year-long effort went to naught, right? Mm-hmm. And so so there's all of these stories, you know, like there was just the anniversary of the Battle of Blair Mountain, where you had all these like coal miners like staying up and mm-hmm. then got shot on by the federal government, mm-hmm. by the National Guard. And so it's an interesting thing where you're like, yes, it's about being white. And people have really long memories, because I live in a place where people really don't move. And so they've right. heard story after story after story after story. And then somebody comes in and says, here's the magic bullet that is going to be the cure for all of the years. And even though, 60% of the people in the area didn't even vote? So 60% were like, I don't believe you, and I don't believe you. Mm-hmm. Right? And I would say they're both right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you have that percentage of people that are so just angry that they're like, I'm going to believe your magic bullet.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
And so I think part of what where I work, we really do strive to work with poor white people. We work with poor people, yep. right? Because mm-hmm. we're like, if we don't work, especially in the South, when there's a huge percentage of poor people, mm-hmm. of poor white people,
yep.
like if we don't figure out how we do this together, and we have all been in this struggle together, it may look different at times, but we're together, how do we move? And I think that's the thing that hasn't actually happened in any part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Nor do I think there's actually really good nuance in what does it mean to live in an area with no toilet paper and no industry? Mm-hmm. So I do cooperative work, and I think this is really important for any rural listeners. Like, what it means to do cooperative work when there is zero industry is very different than to do a conversion in a major city. Mm-hmm. So right now, a lot of the middle-class co-op movement is focusing on conversions. Like, how do we convert a business? And so this is where the Black Lives Matter piece comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm even on the board of one of the organizations that's helping push it, which I love a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But when we know that most black people and most poor people work in corporations that the owners do not have love for.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There is no love for.
Mm-hmm.
So if your number one push is for conversions, then those people will never actually be a part of a worker co-op.
Right.
It will never happen. The only people who will be a part of a worker co-op are people who are within industries where the workers and the owners and whatever are like in cordial relationships, where they believe that, oh, I actually believe in your ability to take my business to the next place. So really a lot of the work we think about now is around value shifting. It's deeper than just education.
Mm-hmm.
It's about values. It's around how do you, like you said, really shift and push against white supremacy on all sides. Mm-hmm. And how do we name capitalism as a problem
mm-hmm.
and not, like, skirt around it to the right? But I feel like the movement is really strong, and I think the work that you all are doing around starting, you know, like, what's a grocery store and a local space? Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that, you know, I was in North Carolina with some friends of mine, and helping them remember is that most co-op grocery stores started as buying clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Then they started as this. Then they moved to this. Then they moved to this. And then they became a grocery store. And so I think one thing that I think for us that's going to be important long term, especially with people who don't come from class privilege, is to say, guess what? Nobody started with a grocery store. Nobody started with a brick-and-mortar grocery store first. That's not how anyone ever started. And mm-hmm. so, like, let's actually start the way that everything else has started so that we know that we're not going to hurt ourselves and that we don't feel bad about what we've done. Because the last thing I'll say that I think is really important is that most people feel like people are being told they're not efficient enough, they're not good enough, they're not moving fast enough, they don't have the things that they need for success. Without having money, without having some of the social connections that you could have, that people don't even know they have, but just like flow out. Like, they just happen to have gone to college with so-and-so-and-so, right? and so I've been really pushing, and we've been really pushing people to name that invisible 10%. Like, why did you really succeed? Did you know somebody who happened to own a building? Did you know somebody else who's friends with the mayor that happened to give you the 10% off the land? Like, what did you, what actually helped you succeed? Mm-hmm. So then who comes behind you can succeed that way. But if you can't, it is okay to start building co-ops the traditional way, right? And then if you're in places in which you have more opening, then by all means do like what they've done in New York and Boston and Greensboro and other places, because they have more influence, and like actually work with city government to help you buy land and work with city government to help. So like in Boston, they just won, they're winning a thing right now so that there can be a center for worker, a center for cooperative development created, which is amazing. Well, and that's a huge win for them.
We're running low on time here.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So don't be sorry at all, because you're offering such amazing stuff here. But I just want to ask you really quickly, if you can, just let listeners know how they can get involved in the work that you're doing, and how they can support projects like the Southern Grassroots Economies project.
Oh, yeah, of course, of course. So I'm Elandria Williams. You can get a hold of me at the Highlander Research and Education Center, or through Beautiful Solutions, or you can look on the Southern Grassroots Economies Project website. And, yeah, you can just find me. You can just type in Elandria Williams. There's only one of me in the world. and, yeah, and please do support. We love people to come from. We would love to do a Colorado Southern Exchange. Let's make that happen.
Absolutely. That'd be awesome.
I think we've just started it now. So thank you so much for joining us, Elandria.
Elandria, I really appreciated what you're saying about the conversion versus initiation point. And one of the great things that the Greensboro, the Renaissance Community Co-op, hit me with was that, you know, we're not trying to create a new business. Groceries happen. People buy food. And the great thing about going after that space as a cooperative effort is you're already doing it. It's in your benefit to do it in a way that benefits each other, that lowers your cost, that gets you better food, et cetera. So the education part of it is just a natural, because it's something that people get, and it's something that's easy to transition to. So I really feel you on the point of trying to do things in a place where it's already being done, and then move on to the larger projects.
That's right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Elandria Williams of the Highlander Center for Research and Education. Thank you, Vince Bowen from Black Lives Matter 5280. You've been listening to the Co-op Power Hour on KGNU's It's the Economy. I'm Nathan Schneider, a scholar in residence of media studies at CU Boulder. This show is where members of the Colorado Co-op Study Circle join you on the fourth Thursday of every month to explore the challenges and opportunities of people-powered democratic economies. You can keep track of future events and shows at coloradocoops.info. And if you want to get more involved in this sort of stuff, I really recommend anyone in the Colorado area to consider attending the Association of Cooperative Educators Conference. That's a continental conference that is happening here in Denver on July 18th to 21st at Regis University. And you can learn more at ace.coop/institute. So I hope to see some of you there. It's a really great opportunity for us to up our skills. I want to thank again our guests today, Elandria Williams of the Highlander Center, Beverly Grant of Mo Better Green, and Vince Bowen of Black Lives Matter 5280. We hope that you'll join us next month, and thanks for being with us. Hey, good thing, you didn't say what you mean.